Some of the most familiar and best-loved parables of Jesus are only told in the Gospel of Luke. For example, very soon we'll be coming up on the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15, which is one of my favorites. But another one of those familiar parables that's only in Luke is what we come to this morning, and that is the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now, today in our society, we still use this term, right? We still say someone acted as a Good Samaritan, typically when they come across a complete stranger that is in need, and there's no reason, really, there's no relationship by which that person would be obligated to serve, but they see, you know, this person has a flat tire by the side of the road, and they stop and they help. Or they see someone is sick and in need of immediate medical attention, and they just simply stop to help. A couple years ago, Marty and I were snowmobiling up in Grand Lake, and she was fully behaving herself as she does, and she was just staying on the trails and riding ahead of me. And I was riding on the trails, and then as we go around all these curves, I just kept going off into the deep powder and coming back on the trail and going off into the deep powder and coming back on the trail. And it was a lot of fun because it's very quiet in that powder, and the powder goes everywhere, and it's beautiful, and it's exciting, it's exhilarating. And one of these times I go off the right side of the trail, and instead of just turning and coming right back on the trail, it was a big shelf of snow that just kind of gave way. And the snowmobile went down and in, and I was stuck. And so I had Marty stop, and she ends up figuring out I'm not right behind her anymore. She comes back. We get the tow rope out, and we try to pull my snowmobile out with her snowmobile, and we end up digging in her snowmobile, and now they're both stuck. And we spend all this time finally getting hers unstuck and mine still stuck, and we're like, we're out here in the middle of nowhere in the Arapahoe National Forest, and we're just stuck. And we've already dug and dug and dug and pulled and lifted and tried all these things. And then this big troop of guys come by in their snowmobiles and they say, hey, would you like some help? We're like, well, yes, obviously we would like some help. And they, like, in just no time at all, several of them just picked this sled up, you know, several hundred pounds, and just literally picked it up and moved it over to the trail. And I thought, boom, Good Samaritan, right? They didn't owe us anything before this. They didn't know us. They just happened to cross us in need. And they helped us out. As I said, we come to this parable this morning, and what I want you to see and understand is that, yes, there is that kind of superficial level of understanding that we perceive that when you stop to help someone in need, even though there's no prior relationship, that is what it looks like to be a good neighbor. And I don't want to say that that's not what this parable is about, but I think as we go through this, you'll see it's about a lot more. So will you join me in Luke chapter 10? I'll begin reading in verse 25. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put Jesus to the test, saying, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said to him, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him. And whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said to him, you go and do likewise. The very first thing I want you to note this morning is a crucial context to the parable. Maybe even as different ones of you have heard this parable retold, you don't have any idea why did Jesus tell this story in the first place? And the reason why Jesus told this particular story at this particular time is important to understanding what he's saying altogether. So look with me at verse 25. It says this lawyer, now we think of a lawyer in terms of legal and suing people in court, but a lawyer back then, the law was the law of God. And so a lawyer was an expert in the law of God. So we would think of him today as more of like a religious professional and not a legal professional. So basically, this pastor, this seminarian comes to Jesus and says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And I want you to notice a couple of things right at the outset, that the first motive of this man and the motive of his question is that he's trying to trap Jesus, which is what the word test means. He's putting Jesus to the test. He's trying to lock Jesus into saying something that will get Jesus in trouble with the religious establishment. But you notice, too, that the question itself that he asks is a self-contradictory question, because he says, "What do I need to do?" What one-time act is the verb tense? What do I need to do to inherit eternal life? Now, I've got children here, and I think we all intuitively understand that my children don't have to do anything to inherit something from their parents. They inherit that by virtue of a status that's been given to them through no fault or no performance of their own. They're simply my children. So he has this self-contradictory question, thinking like, I want to inherit this, but I have this deep nagging sense that we all have to do something for God in order to be saved, in order to inherit eternal life. So what do I need to do? And that's his first motive. Let me trap Jesus into saying something. But you notice Jesus throws it right back to him. Well, how do you read the law? You're the expert. You're the seminary professor. What do you think? And we'll come to that in a moment. But jump ahead to verse 29 then, that when this man then wanting to justify himself because of the answer that he gives, verse 29, he says, who then is my neighbor? Okay, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, Jesus, who is my neighbor? And this spawns this story where Jesus says, okay, your question is, who is your neighbor? Let me show you who your neighbor is. By the way, I'll point out to you, I never noticed this until this time, that if you look at verse 36, which is Jesus' answer, he points out that in verse 29, the lawyer is asking the wrong question, because the man is thinking, who is my neighbor? And Jesus flips it around and basically says, whose neighbor are you? Now, let's go on. That's the context. Let's go to this comprehensive command. So Jesus throws it back to this lawyer. He says, OK, you understand the law. How do you read it? If you want to inherit eternal life on the basis of your own good deeds, how do you interpret it? What do you need to do? And this man quotes the Shema, the most famous verses of the Old Testament to a Jew in Deuteronomy 6. He says, well, it's "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself." And I want you to understand just how comprehensive that is. That when Jesus says, great, you nailed it. Do that and you'll live. What everyone's reaction to that should be, but Jesus, there's no way I can do that. Love God perfectly at all times in every way and love all of my neighbors to the same degree and extent and sacrifice with which I love myself. Jesus, nobody does that. So I can't inherit eternal life on the basis of my good deeds. What else is there? You know, what other way to be saved besides my performance? It should have been his answer. Does that make sense? Because the bar is up here. And what the best of the best of the best of people do is like way down here. We do not love God at all times, in all ways. And we do certainly not love our neighbor as ourself at all times. So now we come to the point of the parable, because the man has just stated to Jesus, the law requires us to love God and to love our neighbors to the fullest extent possible. But now this is why verse 29 is so important, where it's, you know, he then wishing to justify himself. So he's trying to declare himself righteous. He's trying to acquit himself of being guilty of not doing that. And he says, OK, Jesus, but who is my neighbor? And you see immediately what he's doing, don't you? That he's trying to take this massive, all-encompassing command of God. Love everyone at all times. an expansive command, and he's trying to shrink it down and limit it to something that he thinks he can do. Okay, but who's my neighbor? And by the way, this is what self-righteous, legalistic people have done in every generation. If we are trying to bring ourselves to God on the basis of our own performance, we always have to shrink the performance God requires of us. And you notice then Jesus tells this parable, and actually what he's going to do with the parable is where the man is trying to shrink the law of God, Jesus is going to use a story to show him just how all-encompassing the law of God is. Okay, you want to know who your neighbor is? And you want to limit that to the narrowest group of people who think and act and look just like you? Doesn't work that way. And that brings us to the parable itself, which I characterize this parable as a costly compassion is what we're coming to. This is what we see in the parable, is a costly compassion. Let me explain just some of the background of this parable. Very often, as Jesus did, he would take something from the real world that everyone understood. And so this path from Jerusalem down to Jericho is a literal and famous path in the day of Jesus. It was actually called the Way of Blood or the Ascent of Blood because over 17 miles, it dropped 3,000 feet of elevation and it went through an area that looked like this. Today, this is a Greek monastery that is down in one of the wadis. A wadi is just a narrow gully that during the rainy season there's water washing through there and the rest of the year it's just completely dry. But you might be able to see right here at the top of this cliff that there's a little dirt path, and that is literally the same Way of Blood or road to Jericho that he would have placed this man on. Now, it's called the Way of Blood because in Jesus' day, this area was filled with robbers and bandits and highwaymen who would attack travelers, who would pillage them, who would plunder them, and would leave them for dead. And so as Jesus begins telling this story, everyone's thinking, oh, yeah, you don't travel the Way of Blood by yourself. You go in caravans so that you're big enough and safe enough to ward off these highwaymen. Well, this poor unfortunate soul went by himself, and as often happened, he got attacked, he got plundered, and he got left for dead. So picture this. And the first guy Jesus sends down that road is a priest. And it says he's going down the road, which is important, which means he's coming from Jerusalem and going down to Jericho. So what would a priest be doing? He's coming from having just stood before God and offering sacrifices on the people's behalf so they can be rightly related to God. So he's coming from his pious religious performance of his duty before God. And he's walking back and it's like, oh, there's the guy. And he just goes by on the other side. Then Jesus, second, he sends a Levite down that road. And a Levite is like an assistant to a priest from the tribe of Levi. And this whole tribe, basically, back in the Old Testament, they didn't receive a land allotment because their allotment was that they got to serve in the tabernacle and later the temple. And their allotment was receiving gifts from the people. So another religious professional coming from Jerusalem, coming from the worship of Yahweh, and he's passing by, sees this guy in desperate need. It's his own countryman. And he, too, sees it, observes it, and goes by on the other side. Now, I'll just stop there for a moment because there, you can speculate a lot about, like, why did these two men just ignore the desperate need of their neighbor? You know, and a lot of things come to mind. It could be just simply fear. It could be like this guy got beat up and he's kind of like, bait. He's laying here as bait. And if I come to help him, you know, the robbers may be right up there behind those rocks or right over there around the next corner. I stop to help and then I get beat up and my stuff gets taken, too. So fear, a perfectly rational reason why they would ignore this man. There could be piety. It could be that, I'm religious and he appears to be mostly dead or dead. And I'm not supposed to touch a dead body. I'm not supposed to touch blood or I become ceremonially unclean. And there may have been a religious reason that they gave themselves spiritual brownie points for aren't I so wonderful for passing this guy by. You know, it could have just been that they were busy. You know, I'm going to Jericho. I've got a thing to do. I've got, my sundial watch tells me I need to keep moving and get to my thing and do this. And it could have been that they were just apathetic. They just didn't, like their hearts didn't move at all. They saw this and they just didn't care. But here's the point I want to make. Whether it was a judgmental heart of maybe this guy deserved it, whether it was just sheer apathy, whether it was piety, whether it was busyness, whether it was fear. Here's the reality, friends, that if any reason justifies not loving your neighbor, if any reason justifies not loving your neighbor, you will always find a reason. If you can sit there and say, rationally, I'm afraid. Rationally, I don't have the resources to help. Rationally, I'm busy. I got this other thing to do. Rationally, this is too risky. This is too costly. This is too this. This is too that. If we think that way, as the world thinks, we'll always come up with a reason why we don't need to love that next person in the road. By the way, the priest and the Levite would have been very familiar with this category of sin that they're committing. There's kind of two big categories. We often pray this in our renewal time. There are sins of commission, things that you do, and there are sins of omission, things that you leave undone. And obviously what the priest and the Levite are doing here is they're leaving something undone. And it is always a sin to leave undone the good that you could have done today. Even if you're just thinking, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll help this person tomorrow, I'll confess this sin tomorrow, I'll be reconciled tomorrow. It is a sin in God's eyes when we put off the good to tomorrow of what we ought to have done today. By the way, we play this game, too, of like, you know, I don't want to take sides. And maybe these guys are a little bit like that. I don't want to associate with this guy in the road because I don't know what his sins are that led to this. And in coming and helping him, maybe it looks like I'm supporting him. But in not taking sides by helping this man, the priest and the Levite were taking sides. They were taking sides with the robbers and thieves. And how often are these sins of omissions that we commit where, you know, we're just trying to stay neutral. We're trying to be Switzerland, you know, that de facto we are taking a side because we're not doing the positive good for a neighbor that we could do that day. Well, moving on here in the story, something that we would not know, but that the Jews would know, is that as they're hearing Jesus tell the story, okay, a priest came down the road, a Levite came down the road. Now they're like, now the common Jew comes down the road, because that was a very common formula for them. They're like the priest, the Levite, and the common man, the common Jew. And I think the lawyer probably even thinks, okay, I see where Jesus is going with this. Priest and Levite, bad, self-righteous, pious, religious. And Jesus always has this little warfare going on with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes and the attorneys, because he's got this new thing that doesn't look like the old, you know, the old wineskin of Judaism without Jesus. And so he's going to set this up where the hero of the story is this common Jew. And once again, it's going to be an anti-religious establishment parable. Here we go. But you notice that's not who Jesus sends down the road. This is a Samaritan. And if you need the reminder, the Jews hated the Samaritans and the Samaritans hated the Jews, because way back in the Assyrian deportation, there was a group of people, a group of Jews, who started intermarrying with the Assyrians, and they created a half breed of people known as Samaritans. And the Jews sit back and say, we are pure blooded. We are righteous. We are holy. We preserved the one blood, the one seed of Abraham. And then there are these others. And they got their own place of worship. They got their own law of God. Yeah, they do their own thing. And they're evil and we are good. And so what Jesus does, he's telling his story to Jews and to a Jewish religious leader, is like, and then the bad guy came down the road, the guy that's your enemy, the guy that if he found a Jew dying, he would probably stomp on his neck and make sure that he was gone. But you notice that as Jesus sends a Samaritan down the road, I see three things here that are different. Number one, he felt something that the priest and the Levite didn't feel. And Jesus uses the word compassion. And the best thing I can think to relate this to is that sometimes we talk about an emotion in our lives being gut-wrenching, that it's so powerful, that it's so moving. It's like we feel something moving in this part of our body, like in our intestines. It's a gut-wrenching pain. It's a gut-wrenching mercy. That is literally this Greek word that Jesus uses. Is there stuff moving down in this part of the body, viscerally reacting to the need that is observed? So this enemy's coming down the road and he feels something that these others don't feel. Secondly, he risked something that the others didn't risk. The first risk is simply to come over and stop and help this man. because he would have known this is a Jew, the way he's dressed. I mean, everything shows me that he's not one of my people. And again, what if those bandits are up there or around the next corner? And I stop and I help this man, then I run a much higher risk of myself being attacked and being like him. And then we both die, and it would have been easy to rationalize moving on. But he stops and he risks. But you know, the risk is much greater than that, because it says this Samaritan puts this Jewish man on his horse or on his animal, and he takes him to the next town, and he checks him into the hotel, and he says, I'm going to stick around with this guy tonight. And in the morning, I'm going to give you whatever money you need to help him, and then I'll come back and check on him. So just so we can relate to this a little bit better, this is like a High Plains Indian in the 1860s. And he finds a scalped cowboy lying, dying in the middle of the desert. The Indian puts the scalped man on his horse, rides into Dodge City, rents the hotel room above the city saloon, and says, I'm staying here with this cowboy tonight, and I'm going to come back in a few days to check on him. I mean, Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, they'd have that guy handled in no time. Because it wouldn't matter what story he came up with. They'd be like, no, you're the enemy. You're the guy who does the scalping thing. And you're trying to convince us. It's a huge risk that this Samaritan takes to help this Jewish man. But you notice also he spent. He spent his time. He spent his money. He spent his resources. He changed his plans. We don't know what his plans were, but these were not his plans for that day and the next and the next. These were not his plans to come back and check on someone that he'd never met before. You notice at the end of this story, he leaves his care for this man open-ended, saying, if there's anything else this man needs, I will come back and I will repay you for what it takes to make him well. What you notice is he burdened himself. He burdened himself with someone else's burden. There's a very famous sermon by the Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards. And he's talking about this within the context of a church family. And he's talking about the title of the sermon is The Duty of Charity to the Poor. But what he does is he goes through the most common objections that people in his day had for why it's not my responsibility to give to the poor, to help someone else. Well, one of the ones that stuck with me, and I'll just read it to you. But one of them is, well, I can't help my brother or sister without becoming a burden to my own family. You know, we've got our budget and we spend to take care of ourselves. And if I go and help this poor neighbor in need, then I've placed a burden on myself. And this is what he says. He says, if we are never obliged to relieve others' burdens, but only when we can do it without burdening ourselves, then how do we bear our neighbor's burdens when we bear no burden at all? How do we bear our neighbor's burdens when we don't bear a burden at all? You know, Robert was helping me carry tables to set up the children's ministry this morning. You know, and let's say that table weighs 50 pounds. I mean, it's a 50-pound table that I have to pick up. But if he picks up the other side of that, then I only have to carry 25 and he carries 25. But we're both bearing the burden. What we see in this story is that this enemy, this Samaritan, was willing to bear a burden that wasn't his to help someone that he'd never met before. And here's a big point in the story is that I want you to see how Jesus is contrasting the religious, the lawyer's view of neighbor with God's view of neighbor. You notice that to the lawyer, neighbor was a noun. Jesus, who is my neighbor? Noun. To Jesus, neighbor was a verb. To the lawyer, neighbor was something that you have. I have neighbors. Yeah, they live around me. Some of them live in my home. Closer neighbors, you know. To Jesus, neighbors are not something you have, but something that you are. You are a neighbor. And you either are acting as a neighbor or you are not acting as a neighbor, but you are a neighbor. One commentator said this, you can't define your neighbor in advance. You can only be a neighbor when the moment of mercy arrives. It's those people on snowmobiles. They did not define in advance who is my neighbor, who am I willing to help. They just come around a bend, they come up over the hill, there's a need, they stop and help. Here's this Samaritan, he comes around a bend, there's a need, there's a help. And I actually thought that a great metaphor for this is first responders. You know, we have a bunch of medics in our church, paramedics, Some of you work in an emergency room, either at Children's or University or some other place. And I thought of first responders, where if a first responder was thinking, okay, here are my neighbors, and that we define it and limit it so we can be really good neighbors. Well, you have no idea what the next phone call is going to be. As a police officer, you have no idea what the next phone call is going to be. Marty and I were watching this movie yesterday or over the weekend of the Boston Marathon bombing. I was thinking about that, how you just have a common police officer with a limp. You know, he's growing older. He's got problems. And he happens to be one of the guys there that, boom, these bombs go off at the finish line of the Boston Marathon in 2013. And all of a sudden, neighbor is defined very differently for that man. And what it means to be neighborly, to track that whole thing out until there is a safe resolution for others in the giving of himself, in the risking of himself, in the spending of and burdening of himself. He couldn't have defined that in advance. But the moment of mercy arrives and he acts because he is a neighbor. So let's pause here for a moment and let's just do a quick self-evaluation. Okay, how are we doing? And not having neighbors, because you all have neighbors. How are you doing at being a neighbor? Let's start with how you see. You know, obviously, we see the needs in one sense of that, but do you stop and really see them? Do you look at them? Do you feel compassion in your heart? Does your heart break for some of the things that you see in the lives of people that God has put in your road, in your path? Do you see? Do you feel? Do you risk? Do you let God change your plans at a moment's notice, saying, God, I was going to do this today. I was going to shop here. I was going to do this and then this. And like, and yeah, here's this need. But how will I get all these other things done if do you let God providentially redirect you by putting that person in your path who needs the mercy right then? I mean, one of the things that I have a love-hate relationship with this, if I'm being honest about my job. And I tell Marty this sometimes, but I'm like, no day ever looks like what I thought it was going to look like. No day ever looks like what I thought it was going to look like. I carve out chunks of time to do study, to do discipleship, to do counseling, to do these different chunks of things. But how that all gets moved around and what else happens in there is, I mean, it's insane and it's great because that's life. Do you spend your resources, like your time and money, to better the lives of others? Or do you define relationships in terms of what makes economic sense to me? And what I mean by that is, are you my neighbor because I scratch your back and you scratch mine? And it's great to have neighbors like that. You know, I'll pick up your mail when you're out of town and then you'll bring in my recycling bins when I'm gone. So that way neither one of us gets robbed. You know, it's great to have friends and neighbors like that who you're helping each other and you're interdependent. But do you have relationships that make no economic beneficial sense to you at all? And it's simply, this person needs mercy. So let's go here, because there are two responses. You can sit here and you can listen to this. Oh, actually, there are three. You could ignore it. You just be like, I don't care. I really don't care. I'm not going to be a better neighbor because of this sermon that I heard this morning. So there. Or you could say, I am going to be a better neighbor. I need to change. And the legalistic response to change would be, I need to change the level of my behaviors. Okay, so I can see some ways where I'm being selfish with my time, selfish with my resources. I'm not looking. And so in place of those external behaviors, I'm going to slap on a new decision this morning. And you'll change for like a day, maybe, or a week, if you're really, really good at this. The Bible never calls us to that kind of legalistic change the level of behavior response. There is a gospel response. And a gospel response is always not at the level of behavior, but it's at the level of desire. It is letting Jesus Christ transform you at the level of your desires. What do I want in life? What am I living for? So let me take you to this point, point four, a connection to Christ. Because this is what I believe we need to see if we are going to get to this level of gospel response, gospel transformation. Now, many over the years have taught this as an allegory. They basically say Jesus is the Good Samaritan. And they come up with all kinds of fanciful explanations of, you know, the bandits were Satan and the priest was this and the Levite was this. And it's just, it's like, no, okay, this is not an allegory. But what I do want you to see is that Jesus is the only one who lived this way. He's the only one who lived this way perfectly. Let's think about this story and let's understand that Jesus traveled a much greater distance to help enemies with much greater needs at a much greater cost to himself than the Samaritan. I'll say that again. He traveled a much greater distance. He came from heaven, wherever heaven is, to earth. He became fully human without ceasing to be God. Okay, he came a much greater distance than simply the Samaritan going out of his way, taking this man to a Jewish town instead of cutting north then and going back home. He came a much greater distance. He encountered an enemy. We are enemies of God. We are hostile to God apart from Jesus Christ. Okay, and I'm not saying that we feel hostile. I'm not saying that we feel angry. It may even be that we're like the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal. And we're like, how do you say that I'm hostile to God? I'm always doing what God wants me to do. Well, we're alienated in heart. We're at enmity with God. There isn't peace. And he comes to his enemy and he risks everything. And he not only risks everything, but it costs him everything, because he doesn't just lead him into town and say, here's 2 days' wages, which is a big chunk of money to give to someone you don't know. He says, here is my life, my blood, my body broken for you. Jesus died on the cross to take this enemy and make him his friend. At the heart of redemption's story is a Son of God saying, my life for you. Not 2 days' wages, not a little risk or a big risk. My life for you is at the heart of the Christian story. Jesus is the perfect neighbor. But practically for us, what I want us to see is that Jesus is the only one that can cause us to live this way. And I mean, not just in terms of motivating us, as important as that is, but I mean empowering us and equipping us so that we see what Jesus saw, so that we feel what Jesus felt, so that we risk what Jesus risked, and so that we spend what Jesus spent. And friends, I believe that if we want to change at the level of desire, the very first thing we need to do is meditate on stories like this until we understand Jesus was the perfect neighbor. I was lying dead in my trespasses and sins. I wasn't dying. I was dead. I was spiritually separated. I was spiritually gone. And he gave me new life. And the reason that I can love others is because I have first experienced Christ's love for me. You know, you can never give what you have not first received. But if you receive the kindness and the compassion and the love and the resources of Jesus to the point of overflowing, then the instinctive response of your heart to the needs of your neighbors would be to overflow into them. I think the biggest thing we need to do with a story like this is let the grace of the Samaritan capture your heart. Don't just let it be a mental story of like, yeah, I know I should do better and be like that. Let something more visceral, something more existential happen in your life where you're like, if somebody really did that, like that kind of risk and putting him on his beast and taking him into town and 2 days' wages right off the bat and anything else I have to spend to help this man, let that win your heart. This is what Christ did for me and so much more. And then go and be the kind of neighbor that Christ is to you. I think this is one of those areas where there is a massive gap in Christianity, in church, between our profession and our practice. I think this is an area where we're like, yes, of course, I love. Yes, kindness and compassion. I'm one of the merciful. And that is our profession. That is what we say. But day after day, then we pass by needs and we just simply omit. We just simply don't look. We just simply don't feel. We just simply don't risk. We simply don't spend our resources to make the lives of other people better. And I was thinking over the weekend, if we're trying to shrink this gap between our profession and the practice of our faith, the natural way that we do that is like the lawyer, right? We're like, okay, the profession was too big for the practice to match. So let's shrink the profession and let's make the profession smaller. Let's limit it. Okay, so I'll treat my wife this way this week. Or my kids will get this from me. You know, I'll shrink it down so I'm not professing something really big. And what we're doing is we're like, okay, I need to make it smaller and more doable. And then that gap between profession and practice will go away because I've shrunk it down. I've made it more doable. But do you know that's not what Jesus calls you? He doesn't say shrink it down, make it more doable. This is why he's telling the story. He's like, are you kidding me? Drop a bomb on that bad boy. Blow it up. Make it expansive. Make it so you understand this is not something that the really good, really compliant, really high performance Christians do. This is so big and so comprehensive, it is impossible. And once you've arrived at the point of saying, I cannot possibly love my neighbor the way that Jesus calls me to, then you're in the right place because you can say, help. Help me, God. I want to do what you called me to do, but it's too big. It's too great. It's too above and beyond and outside of me. If this is going to happen, this is what we prayed Friday night, then it's going to have to be the fruit of your Spirit living in me and through me, bearing that love and joy and peace, the sacrifice for the good of others. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful. You know, we come to Jesus and we say, I wish I could do what you called me to, but I can't, but I want to. Jesus, will you fill me with you? You who are the only one who ever did what we read in this story, will you fill me with that? And then cause that to overflow from my life into the lives of other people. I believe that Jesus will answer that prayer with a resounding yes, because this is what the mission of your life looks like. Now, let me close with a couple cautions. I intend for this last point to just be super practical for you, okay? That's the theological, is that God's going to have to do this in us and through us by transforming our own desires and overflowing with himself into the lives of other people. But you know, you'll never do this until, number one, you take off your blinders. Because it starts with, if you don't see the need in the first place, you're not going to do anything else in sequence that we read in the story. Jesus says, go and do likewise. You're not going to go and do likewise if you don't see the need in the first place. You ever been in a situation where you're sitting there and it just something never occurs to you, but then you see someone else observe a need and they hop up and help? And you feel that feeling like, why didn't I notice that? Why didn't I see that? And this is going to be different for every one of you, but there are physical, there are emotional, there are psychological, there are spiritual blinders that simply prevent us from seeing the needs that our neighbors have in the first place. Let's start with the physical. You know, it could be as simple as, you know, our culture today. You are always looking at your phone. And there is all kinds of needs, like in a 6-foot perimeter to your life, and you are right here. Or something like right here, such a digital age. And it may even be like, oh, I'm encouraging this person on Facebook. Bam, send it. Okay, so encouraged. And maybe it's just that simple, that God would have you physically look up from something that is a constant distraction to your life and to your relationships. You know, maybe it's that literally every night you drive home and you're tired and you open your garage door and you drive your car in. And while you're still sitting in your car, you hit that button, your garage door closes. And you're done for the night. You don't acknowledge that you really even physically have neighbors. You're just inside. And I'd encourage you, because the weather's getting warmer, this is a great time of year to say, Lord, make me intentional to get outside of my home sometimes. I know some of you are more introverted, but get outside of your home sometimes. Work in the yard. Talk to a neighbor. Get to know them. See them. Look at them. So that you can start to understand what some of their needs are. You know, I've got friends that, it's just simply that the hobbies that you've chosen for yourself are hobbies that turn you in on yourself. And they're very introverted and kind of private things. Again, it's fine for you to have that hobby. I'm not even calling out a particular hobby. But maybe that's a blinder where you realize I sit at this desk or this computer. I do this thing all the time. And even in my quote unquote free time, my elective time, I'm turned in on myself and I don't see needs because I'm not giving myself opportunity to. Okay, those are some physical things. Emotionally, psychologically, you know, you can carry so much baggage with your own emotional mess and your thought life that it's not like physically you don't see it. It's that emotionally you're not in a healthy place to do anything about it. You're like, you know, I'm depressed myself. I'm just super depressed. I'm bitter about this thing that happened in my past. And maybe there's a need in front of me, but what comes out of my mouth is bitterness because I just feel bitter. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. And I was thinking this past week about how when I get frustrated, I just shut down. I mean, anybody else? It's just like the world turns in and the frustration gets big. And that's what I carry rather than saying like, okay, I acknowledge I'm frustrated, God. You already know that. Okay, bye-bye frustration. Hello, fruit of the Spirit. You know, I need to change my thinking so that I can see the needs around me. And then just spiritually, you know, obviously any sin will blind you, but primarily the sin of pride or selfishness. Often we see the same needs as someone else, but we don't really see them just simply because the natural bent of our heart is what's good for me. How does this benefit me? That doesn't benefit me to stop and help. I'm going to keep right on going. Or judgment. And this may have been the priests and the Levites seem to the religious in Jesus' day seem to have a negative explanation for every bad thing that happened to other people. You ever notice that? Why is this guy blind? Did he sin or did his father sin? And Jesus is like, well, actually, it's not either one of those. It's so that I could be glorified. Oh, we haven't heard that one. Tell us more, you know. But they see this guy in the road. And I mean, that may have been the whole deal. It's like, judged by God, not my business. And you can see someone in poverty. You can see someone in a condition with an addiction or something and feel in your heart. Just the first thing is judgment. Like, I would never land there on a street corner doing this because you're lazy. And it's just easy, and this is in Edward's sermon as well, it's easy to just ascribe a whole backstory to someone that you don't know their backstory and to assume it's God's judgment. So maybe spiritually those blinders need to come off. But I want you to do this. I want you to be very serious about, Lord, physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, what is blinding me to the needs that are around me? And then finally, live with margins. Live with margins in your life. It is going to cost you to help other people, period. It's going to cost you to be a Christ-like neighbor. It's going to cost you your two most precious resources, which are your time and your money. And here's my thing that I was just thinking to try to be practical to you. If you take your budget, here's my income, and you figure out a budget that you spent all of that, where's your margin to help other people? You take your schedule, you schedule it all full. Boom, I am so uber productive. Why can't other people be as productive as me? There's no downtime. Great. Where's the margin to stop and to be inconvenienced and to let God providentially change your schedule? Live with margins financially. Live with margins in your time. Some of you are just like, church starts at 9:45 and I'm trying to be there by 9:53. And then something goes sideways and you're walking in the door at 10. Where's your margin to have a conversation beforehand and say, hey, you're my neighbor. And whether we've met or not, what do you need? How can I serve you? How can I pray with you or for you? How can I love you with the kind of love that Christ loved me with? And it's just simply a decision of like, hey, family, we have to create these margins so that we're free. We are spiritually free to give and to love. Again, this is an area where I think there's a big gap between the profession of our faith and the practice of our faith. R. Kent Hughes, another pastor, said, it is not uncommon to love the idea that you love people and are their benefactor, rather than to actually love people themselves. And we could probably all find ourselves guilty in that phrase that, of course, we like to think of ourselves as very kind, very generous, very giving. And we love that idea of I'm such a generous person. But there's no such thing as loving the idea of being a kind, compassionate, generous person. You either do these things and practice these things or you do not. And I want you to understand this morning, this is not a call to perfection. This is not a call to like suddenly you're scrambling and you're frantic. And if you're hearing this, don't hear it this way. This is not now you need to be the savior of the world. Now you need to notice every little thing that's going on everyone's lives and you need to fix it. You don't fix it and you don't do it with everybody. You do it with somebody. And you bring to them the resources that God has brought to you and you lead them to Jesus and let God fix them, Because the more you try to fix people, you will be frustrated because they will not get fixed. And they will be frustrated because they don't want that kind of relationship with you. How many of you love it when someone shows up in your life and they're like, I am here to fix you. My husband is my project. I am going to fix him. There's no husband that likes that. There's no wife that likes that. Our children don't like that. Our neighbors don't like that. And I'm not talking about this frantic thing that we now do, all this stuff. I'm saying we look, we feel, we give. And all this is just a call to intentionality and a call to mission. As God does something in me and through me to overflow with Jesus being the perfect neighbor. And now I'm a much better neighbor because I see this comprehensive command and I let God do it in me.